follow-up interview with Herman Hawthorne, Hawthorne, Wilbraham, Massachusetts, April 16, 1984, interviewed by Larry Lowenthal.
One building, 20, caught on fire. It was caught on fire because one of the construction workmen tipped over a salamander and hit a great big tarpaulin that he had, and the whole building went up. And the fire department couldn't do much with the pipeline there because they all rusted up, and only a trickle of water came out of their little fire tower. So after that, and after it had burned down, they put in new pipes all the way through. It just hadn't had maintenance money up until then.
Were they pipes on the armory ground or city pipes?
Armory pipes, yeah. Uh-huh. Their own water supply, or tapped into city, but their own distribution.
Where were they trying to tap?
Well, the various hydrants they had in the armory ground. They had one of these devices with a nozzle, and you tap in three hydrants and put a lot of water in. Supposedly they got a good stream. It didn't go out more than about 15 feet because of rust. And that really put that contractor out of business because it hadn't been delivered to the government. It wasn't a government building at that time. Uh-huh. Contractor was, I believe, Rylander. I'm not sure of that, but he went broke after that because he had his money into it, and he didn't have enough insurance.
And it was one of his own workmen that...
One of his own workmen that knocked it over.
No one believed it was sabotage, even...
Oh, no, not at all. No, they knew what it was.
Obviously an accident.
Yeah. Yeah, they had one of these little heating things. It was, I don't know what time of year it was, but it was cold enough that they had a heater going. He kicked it over, and there was a big tarpaulin hanging down. That caught on. He just went up and hit the framing, wiped it out. It was very intense heat.
I've seen pictures where there was a big crowd across Pearl Street all standing there watching it.
Well, we were in Building 28, which gave us a beautiful view of it. They just opened up Building 28. That was a new building then.
Was Building 20 rebuilt, or was it a totally new building?
It was a new building then, as I recall.
In other words, there was nothing on that site?
No, it wasn't tear down and replaced. It was a new building.
Somewhere in that area, they had the old pond for the fire trucks, but was that gone by the time you came?
Yes, it was gone by the time I got there. You have it in your drawings, and I can't tell you exactly where it was.
Yeah.
They still had the engine house, the railroad track, so...
There was a coal pier down in that area that they dropped coal cars out in that vicinity.
Well, I know they had railroad tracks and bringing things in, so they probably did through that, but I remember the tracks... over in back of Building 27, in that little house where the fire engine now is, I think. Mm-hmm. That was
the engine house.
That was the engine house.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things I thought we might cover, and if you have the stuff on them, why, we'll ignore it. If you don't, why, we can cover it now. We had foreign contacts with both Germany and with France on weapons. In fact, I went over and wrote up the notes of material for the HS-20, 20-millimeter gun, working with the people in Meppen in northern Germany.
What period are you talking about for that?
Oh, that was in late 50s.
Okay.
Mid to late 50s. And we did quite a bit of interchange with the French over in Mulhouse. They had a corresponding arsenal system to ours, and they were late at the end of it. They were going through the same deal that we did of closing down an arsenal and being moved somewhere else to the south of France.
Hmm. Is that why you had contacts with them, or was it about a particular
No,
weapon?
We had contacts with the various guns, particularly the revolver gun and the Hispano-Suiza, 20-millimeter. And barrel work, quite a bit on barrel work, because we did a lot of barrel development. Even had our own barrel shop then, Building 32.
Because at that time the French were trying to develop a similar gun?
That's right, and so were the British. And the barrels, it was all of them we were working with. But the Germans had the Hispano gun, and we were writing notes material, and we were picking up as an interim gun. And we were trying some of our, exchanging information on our guns with them. Mm-hmm. See, the revolver gun evolved from a German gun. And I mentioned the other time this paperclip operation. Well, from the paperclip operation, we got Otto von Lausnitzer, who'd been with Mauser and working on the gun, on small arms. So when we got him in here, he went to work on the design, and we probably picked up 3 to 5 years in the developments with the knowledge that he brought. And they were way ahead of us in several things.
The Germans were?
Yes. Well, for example, they just handling the drawings. When he left Mauser, he took with him in a shoebox microfilms of all of the prints that they had. And we were just beginning to get into microfilm. But he could carry with him all of their records in just one small shoebox with that method. And we were quite a bit later getting into it. So he had some of that information. The paperclip, to go back a bit, I don't know what you have in that, but the paperclip was instituted by Anna Rosenberg, who was working for Roosevelt. We were trying to pick up German scientists after the war was over in Germany.
Did this idea start before the war was over?
I don't know when the idea started, but we started picking them up as there was all this confusion when the war was over. And they sent a team over there to try to capture and get scientists away from the others. And we got Otto, and the British were also trying to get him. And Colonel Sepfons, who was later at the Army, was part of the recovery team trying to get Otto. It was the same operation that brought von Braun and the whole bunch down to Huntsville.
And the Russians were trying to get
Yeah, everybody was trying to get everybody. So it was right at the close of the war. Well, we were lucky enough to get both Otto and to get Dr. Karl Meyer.
In other words, they had their eye on these people. They knew them by
name. Sure.
They knew Meyer and von Lossen.
Yeah, yeah.
Specifically went after them.
Well, von Lossen, he was director of research for Mauser, so he'd obviously be a prime target. And he was under wraps and kept confined here for, I think, a year. Couldn't go off the Army grounds until he more or less got an approval from the immigration people.
Where was he? What building was he in?
Officer Club.
Did he live there too?
Yeah, yeah.
With a security guard around him?
I don't think so. No, they had guarding the gates, but he was perfectly willing to, but he just couldn't travel over the country or take off anywhere. But he gave us a lot of valuable information. He was not only knowledgeable in the mechanical part of it, but he was an excellent person for reading organization charts and finding out which one you go after. Huh. Which is an act.
Did he speak English at that time?
Oh, beautifully.
Really?
Almost everybody over there speaks English. But he was a real push. I know he was telling one time about when he was a lieutenant in the German army, and he would go to a dance. He was a beautiful dancer. And he would take three uniforms with him. Because he'd get sweat and get one dirty, and then he'd go change another one, and then change on later, keeping himself immaculate. I went to a trip over there quite a bit later, and I met his sister.
Still in Germany?
In Germany, and she was quite prominent in the Red Cross and recovering and helping families. Maria von Gielser. I went and visited her. She lived only about 8 miles from this installation in Meppen that I was going to work with the Germans, so I took time off to go and see her. And she hadn't seen Otto since he left the country, and she couldn't leave the country. Couldn't or wouldn't, I don't know which. She said, I'll come over here anytime you want, and I'll see you if it's anywhere in Germany, because she had a pass that she could travel anywhere into Germany, but not outside it. But she died the next year when we went over. Mm. Remarkable woman. They were both quite nice. Karl Meyer brought a lot on springs. He was very expert on spring design, which was a radical thing for our guns. We had, as I said the other day, these surges in a long spring in the gun. You get these surge waves that are going back and forth. And he had developed for some of the German guns, I believe, and got us into doing it here, a stranded wire spring, which instead of being a solid core spring you've seen in some of the guns, were made up of a twisted wire. Well, this twisted wire gave you a damping effect on the waves that were traveling up and down the spring. And every now and then you would, with a solid wire spring, you would have these waves go down and reflect and come back and interfere with another one and intensify the stresses that are in the spring. Well, the stranded wire just damped it out and stopped that. So your springs had a lot longer life. And they went into the M60 machine gun as standard. And we worked with a place, I think it was Hunter Spring in Lansdale, Pennsylvania, who developed fabricating methods for those.
But the concept came from Germany.
Concept came from Germany, yeah. And Jim O'Neill, who was working for Karl Meyer at the time, did a lot of development work on springs and designing them and testing them. We had one thing that we were quite proud of, and that was a First, we had the time displacement camera that we developed so that you could get reflected light and get the motion of the bolt going back and forth against time, and you could find out where what was going too fast or not going right, or you were getting interferences. So he worked up a great big drum that would test the spring under the same loading circumstances that it got in the gun, and not with the ordinary sign testing that most spring testers will give you. Mm. So you'd get these reflected waves and the stress concentration, and you could work around it and improve it in that way. Also, if you had buffers that were breaking up or something of that sort, because there's too much velocity hitting the back end, Cal used to say 55 feet per second was about all any material would take without giving you fatigue breaks after a while. So there's a lot of mechanical development that was very peculiar to the Army. It wasn't done anywhere else. Where that stuff is done, I don't know.
Where is it done nowadays?
Yeah. Maybe one of the private spring companies would have probably developed some, but I don't know who's doing it now, even where all that equipment went. And I know Jim O'Neill's gone into Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, so he's not doing it. Hmm. And Frank Ledoux and Chad Beegian and Ernie Sahornitz are all the people in the photo lab who did the work on all of this development of time displacement curves and analysis of them. And Betty Sullivan did the analysis. He had machines for that. And that stuff has all been disbanded.
We've talked to some of the photographers, but not on tape yet. We keep meaning to do that.
Yeah. Well, Frank and Ledoux did a lot of the high-speed photography, and Ernie Sahornitz probably was a wheel horse on that. He's still in the area, I think. Outside it, he's running a movie camera somewhere for a movie house, which is a bit of a come down.
Yeah.
But the brains and all of that stuff on the spring design were primarily with Jim O'Neill and Carl Meyer. And Carl Meyer set his own company up and worked independently. And I told you that he had a company in this country and a company in Germany. So he's working back and forth. He lives down in Boynton Beach now, in Florida. If you ever wanted the address, I think I have it somewhere.
Where's that Jim O'Neill live? Is he the one that lives in Western Massachusetts?
I think he's down in Washington somewhere.
Oh.
I heard he's in his 16th, so he probably is in Washington. And we did a lot in barrel development. I assume you've talked to some people on that, so most of the people that did that have died since, Bob Eves in particular. We got into that initially with the Cal 50 Browning and the start of World War II. And we were getting reports of bullets coming out of the side of the barrel because the barrel got so hot, and these long bursts from airplanes. Mm. So that's what started the Sonnet, and eventually turned into the Stellite lineup, which took the bulk of the heat and kept the bullets from coming out the side, and then the chrome plating, which preserved the accuracy, let's say in the last 4, 5, 6 inches of the muzzle.
Were these all developed at the armory?
Yeah.
Any names in particular that you would associate?
Bob Eves in particular.
Yeah. But for the liner?
Yeah. And he was a metallurgist, and he came to us from American Optical in Southwick.
Hmm. When did he come, do you remember?
Right in the middle of the war.
Just for that purpose?
Well, no, they're hiring anybody they could get.
Yeah.
Then.
But he came as a metallurgist?
Yeah, he had retired from American Optical and picked this up as a second job, and that finally became his prime job.
They assigned him to that?
Yeah. He worked with all kinds of materials and worked out that Stellite liner, and he was working with titanium liners, moly liners, all sorts of exotic materials if you want. But that's the one that just stayed to be the workable one.
Was it sort of a trial and error test of different materials?
Yeah, well, just knowing them, but more with some knowledge of what they might
do. Sure, knowing which ones have some possibilities.
Yeah. And we had problems, of course, with erosion there. We worked with Ford on barrels quite a bit, too, on the revolver gun, because we would be getting erosion right at the face of the barrel, and they worked out the ball joint at Ford Motor, which gave you a better alignment of the contact between the barrel face and the chamber, and it kept it from eroding there. It was self-seeding by having this ball joint in your liner there. And the names there were Bob Lessman and Joe Johnston and John McDonald. Those were the two, Bob Lessman and Joe Johnston, head of the operation at Ford. Ford ran their contract operation.
Where was Ford doing that? In Michigan?
Yeah,
Dearborn?
River Rouge, yeah, Dearborn. And they set up a complete weapon section. The people who worked for Ford on our contract did not have anything to do with the Ford Motor Company itself and engines, and they didn't transfer back and forth. They kept them as a separate entity, and they had no prospect of promotion into the Ford hierarchy. It worked out quite well. They did good work.
How long did that contract go on, do you remember?
Oh, years.
Beyond
at least 5 or 6. Yeah, it went beyond the war.
Yeah.
Our various contracts that we had during the war and after the war were Ford, Oldsmobile, Pontiac was the production of the weapons, GE of course, Bridge Tool and Die in Philadelphia, and Armour Institute of Technology, Illinois Institute of Technology, Armour Research Foundation, Winchester and Remington, Firestone, Saginaw Steering, and Avco. So we had quite a spread of contracts with the various weapons.
What sorts of things were they doing, briefly? Can you
well, Avco, for example, was working on the grenade launcher. Ford was working on the revolver gun. Olds and Pontiac were also working on the revolver gun. GE was on the M61, the Gatling gun. Ridge Tool and Die was on the small machine guns.
Now, it seems like we're seeing a tendency here in which the research function was being taken out of the armory and given to private contractors even back then.
Well, we tried to run all the time somewhere between 45 and 55% in-house work versus out-house work. And the idea was that we would try to have some function going inside the armory that was either part of a major job or comparable to a competitive job, so that you were able to evaluate the contractor's work through people who are knowledgeable by doing the same work.
Is that what you were doing personally?
Well, personally, I was managing.
Okay. Who was making the decisions about which contracts stayed in and which ones went out?
Well, they generally went on bids.
Okay.
But after a while, you were getting continuing contracts because you had so much money invested in the people and the knowledge that it was just a continuing one. And this was worked through Army Weapons Command and then through OCO.
Did the Armory bid, so to speak, on these contracts?
No.
How did they determine which
would be in, which would
be
out?
Yeah.
That was generally done in Washington. We presented our case as to why we should be doing what, and to be Washington and then later Army Weapons Command. And they were managing how much went in, how much went out.
Did you compete for any of these in the sense that the Armory was trying to get some of these same contracts that went private?
Not generally. We generally were sharing, and there's plenty to go around.
I mean, none of these contracts then that were contracted out would have, let's say the Armory would not have wanted any of these?
There weren't enough people to handle them.
Yeah. Without a big jump in manpower.
Yeah. And you had ceiling levels all the time.
Yeah.
And there weren't that many people available. You can get the draftsman, but when it comes to small arms designers, we had quite a large portion of the country's designers in the armory.
So it seems like the armory management was satisfied to do a certain amount of contracting out rather than increasing its own workforce.
Yeah, and you didn't have the people, you couldn't get the people to do it. At that time, your engineering people and experienced people were very much in demand. They could probably do better outside than in after the war was over.
Yeah. In other words, the armory couldn't compete financially to get some of these people, even if it had wanted to.
Well, we were under this restriction, again, as I said, of around 50% in-house. And we kept it right around 50% in-house, and the rest to be out, so you had a broader base.
Yeah.
If we tried to get more in and put people in and shut off some of the outside, we'd have been clamped down on by Washington, who set the policy for half in, half out. And when they came through there, the inspectors all reviewed what we had for contracts and how much and where. But the whole point was to maintain a knowledgeable base rather than a large development base. Well, you look at the designers that we had. And we had Earl Harvey, Lloyd Corbett, Jack Lockheed, Dick Colby, Cy Moore, Art Meyer, John O'Brien, John Rocha, and Charlie Packard. Well, that's quite a run of designers. And you start finding that many basic designers outside, and you'll be hard put to find that many.
Well, why didn't some of them try to find jobs in private industry?
We paid them pretty well.
Paid enough to keep them.
We paid enough to keep them. And again, this once you've gotten in quite a large amount of years, it's your interest to stay in, because generally there's a better retirement than if you go out and start over again with a company outside from zero. Mm. You know the retirement system as it existed then, and it was...
Still does, basically.
Some alteration, some of it's better. While we're operating, your salary was based on the high five instead of the high three. And you didn't get any allowance for the sick leave that you left, which you do now apply to your retirement. I had over a year's sick leave accumulated when I retired.
We don't get paid for the sick leave.
No, but you get credit as if it
credit
were,
as if you worked high it. Three or
well,
five.
For me, it'll be another year's service.
Yeah. Were any of these names you mentioned designers around up to the end?
Well, Earl Harvey was. Lloyd Corbett died, so he wasn't. Jack Lockheed died shortly before. Dick Colby went to some design place out in California, and I can't tell you which one it is.
So some of them went on working beyond the closing of the Armory.
Earl Harvey retired when the Armory closed. I said Lloyd Corbett was dead, Jack Lockheed was dead, Dick Colby kept on working, Cy Moore was dead, Art Meyer went over to GE with the M73, John O'Brien went over to GE with the M85, and John Rocha transferred to somewhere and then got out to Rock Island back in the design area. Hmm. And Charlie Packard, I think, retired. I don't know what he did, really.
Do these men tend to work on one particular weapon for a long period of time?
Yes.
And become specialists in one weapon design?
Yes, very much.
So when they left, though, they, sometimes there was no one else who had that knowledge.
That's right, yeah. That, it was sad to see it break up, because you had background and they could at least tell you what didn't work, maybe not what did work, but that's just as important. Let's see, Lloyd Corbett was a specialist in the M14, and Earl Harvey was head of the design group over there, total group, development branch. But he was a rifle specialist. And Jack Lockheed was a light machine gun specialist. Dick Colby worked in the T-220. And since Cy Moore worked on the M-78 grenade launcher. And before that, he worked on the T-28 light rifle, which went down the drain, so something else came in ahead of it, but it's just that was just too bad. He had a good design, I think. Art Meyer was a specialist in the M73. He was one that got sent to Europe, helping them over there when they were sending it out through Germany. John O'Brien was an excellent designer in the M85. Rocha was on the 30mm. Tony Ariza, who died, was his boss. Charlie Packard was on rifles.
Now, the ones you mentioned that were working on the M14, what did they go on to do once the M14 was adopted?
Well, I asked you the last time if you know anything what happened to the SPEW program. Well, they went out of that program, which was Special Purpose Individual Weapon. Do you have any of the Flechette ammunition at the Army Museum?
It's possible. I'm not really sure.
Because it fired the Flechette, and this was in competition with the Armalite. And see, we were developing this one with this particular ammunition, whereas Armalite was developing its own with their own particular type of ammunition. And here's where you had a competition inside and out. But it went all the way through to the testing, that competition.
So it seems like in the closing years at the Armory, there were people who were willing to get away from the kind of traditional wooden stock.
Oh, wooden stocks are long gone.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we had... Well, your Armalite was all a plastic stock.
And the Armory was...
Well, the trouble with the wooden stock here is that you get these high rates of fire and the temperature, the wood doesn't stand up.
So the armory too was going in that direction?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
On its own?
Well, we originally, as I mentioned the last time, one of my first jobs, I was working with Firestone down in New Bedford to replace the burning wooden stock because they're having breakages on it, and we worked out a plastic stock with them. We did quite a bit in the early parts of the war of trying to find an alternative to black walnut. And the advantage of black walnut is that it has both the radial and the tangential shrinkage are equal. So that as the wood dries out, you don't get warpy or anything of this sort. You know how a plank will warp or a pine board or something.
Yeah.
Well, they shrink in different directions. And if they have an equal rate of shrinkage, why, it's less likely to warp. And that's why they used walnut. Oh, we worked with pecan, we worked with birch and all of this. And we worked with treatments that wouldn't smoke up on heavier fire.
Black walnut's hard to find anymore.
Yeah. Well, even then, they're having people go all over the country, and the walnut trees that don't grow in groves, they grow in people's yards singly.
And they grow slow, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Another deal I wanted to mention, I don't know what your head on, was I getting this range out of Corbin. That was quite a help.
Yeah, that's an interesting subject. I haven't talked to anyone yet who had any experience with that. I mean, we know there was a range out there, but we don't know too much about it.
Well, we found, of course, that we, in the initial part of testing, when we were still growing as an organization, we would send something down to Aberdeen, and we'd find it just didn't work down there for one reason or another. We had no way of testing at altitudes. One of the problems that came in was with this old pedestal mount for the Browning. You probably have one in the museum. It's just a pedestal mount, and the fellow sits back and shoots anti-aircraft.
Yeah.
Well, they were finding that all of a sudden they'd be shooting up there and the gun would stop. And they were getting a feedback and vibration from the firing of the gun and into the mount that would work against the spring. And you know how you catch a baseball and your hand goes back and there's right. No zip? Well, the spring would do this, go back, and it wouldn't push the ball forward. Hmm. So we had to make studies on vibration to find out just what was causing the stoppage and the relation, the frequency of the mount to the frequency of the gun. And again, so you wouldn't get this unfortunate imbalance. We worked out a bunch of spring mounts down in the Army, but we still wanted to do overhead firing. So we negotiated with the Metropolitan District Commission. That was when Frank McMahon was CEO here. And Charlie Sepfront and I did a lot of the dickering with the commission, walked all over Quabbin trying to find a place that would be safe to set up a range. And did. We located that, and it worked out quite well. We were going to put up a permanent, really permanent range house there, but we ran into the problem of the fact that we didn't own the land, and the government wouldn't put money into a building on land that it didn't own. And as it turned out, it's just a well, because when the Army went, that whole thing went over to the district.
Why did they pick Quabbin? Was it because it was just the largest open area?
Well, it's a hard place to find that distance where there isn't somebody or a road crossing. We tried Ludlow Reservoir for a while, and we could get a pretty good range there just for a distance. But about 5 degree elevation or something, you'd be shooting over the hill and into somebody's house. And they didn't approve of that.
Hardly.
So you look at your map, and there aren't too many open areas that don't have public roads.
Were they shooting out over the water at
Quabbin? Oh, yeah. In fact, we found could have been an unfortunate thing. It wasn't, but when we were firing at elevation, we found that the maximum elevation was almost on an intersection line with the glide path to the main runway at Westover. So we worked out an arrangement with the tower there so there'd be nobody coming in when we were firing. When we first started out there, they didn't have jet airplanes, and you could have somebody watching around to see there's no airplane coming. But then they began getting jets at Westover, and they'd get there before the sound would, so that didn't work, and we got a radio communication. But the air kind of stood up straight at Westover when we told them where our trajectory was.
Where was the range located at Quabbin?
Well,
let's say, which side of the reservoir did you fire
south.
From?
It's on the south side.
South?
Yeah.
Like which?
You go over near the
dam. For the main
well,
dam.
You go over the main dam, keep going a bit on the way out on the road over toward Weir. and it's a little side road that goes down into the... Don't you have a map of that there?
Yeah, we probably do.
You do, I think.
Work, yeah.
But it was good because there was no fishing in that area. It was all restricted area.
What did they do? Fire northward, basically? Then?
Yeah.
Along
the axis of the reservoir. And we put up a good concrete mount there, and we could do quite a lot of good testing.
Was that something, kind of a duty that people considered? How did people get out to the range?
Well, we had a range truck going out, and we had a government car. But the range truck was a mobile tool operation. And as I said, we had a permanent building out there and left quite a few tools and things there. So it made a good mobile shop, repair shop. And it was separated from the main traffic. We had a private road down there and a gate and a lock so that people didn't ever get down and bother us.
What kind of truck was it?
I don't remember. No, not any idea. It's just a typical OD truck with a lot of room in it.
Yeah.
Oh, what else did I want to mention? Oh, some of the things we did, I think we were the first, or at least one of the first, to use titanium in a weapon. And it went in the piston in the revolver gun. We were getting breakages in there because it would be checked and you'd get the head breaking off the shank, and somebody had the idea of one of the metallurgists of trying titanium in there. We tried it, and it just solved that very nicely. We were one of the first in audience to get into this program evaluation review technique network system, and we had Jim O'Neill and Dave Katz going around lecturing other ordnance installations on how it worked. And we used that very much for control of our programs. I think you asked me last time about not how it worked, but basically, it's like planning a meal. If you're going to have a lot of people come in, some stuff takes a half an hour to cook, and some takes 3 hours, and some takes 45 minutes, and some may take a day. Well, you want to know when to start and how much effort to put in on each one so that you come up with them all done at the same time. And it has gone on quite a lot as the computers have been brought in, but it was new for us.
Who was that attributed to? Do you know the original idea?
Oh, I don't.
Do you think that started at the Armory?
No. It was a mathematical technique that was developed probably in one of the universities. But our people stayed abreast and stayed at things like that. Jim O'Neill, being a mathematician, he picked it up and got it applied here, and we used it. Another deal that I thought was pretty good that we did was this precision casting. And the way that worked out, I think, was the way it should operate. We got into this precision casting for parts, and a lot more economical than machining them. And you're probably familiar with that in manufacturing, but we got our people, a small group together, working on it and developing the methods and the machinery and the inspection methods with the ultrasonics. And when we got all done with the package, we turned it completely over to manufacturing with the personnel. And this is the way I think a lot of our stuff was headed and should have kept on going. You take a process, you investigate it, you work it out, you develop it so that it's ready for production, then you get out of it and you pass the whole thing over to the manufacturing. And if they're in trouble, they have the people right there and they can come back and ask for more. But then you're through with it and you don't stay with it, you go on to the next new thing.
Was that casting, the wax casting?
Yeah, the last wax.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whose idea was that, do you think?
Well, Harold Hatch was a prominent one in it. He did most of the basic groundwork.
Supposedly, that's a very old technique.
It is. It was in the jewelry industry. But I think somebody had been trying it in the industry, and we figured it was good and had seen some of it. And got the equipment, tried it, but so much of it relies on the ability to have the people familiar with it and to get the equipment that's required. One thing we always wanted to do and never could do was to get into the National Toy Fair. And we even tried to put some leverage, but got nowhere. But if you look at toys as they are made, then and now, there are a lot of ingenious mechanisms. And if you could only get in and look at those mechanisms and look them over, you could translate some of their ideas into your own mechanisms.
Why not just go out and buy the toys?
Well, yeah, but they're all together at the toy fair.
Yeah.
you can't send somebody down to the toy shops hoping you're an end of something, but the toy fair, they bring in all their new ideas once a year.
Getting back to this lost wax casting, what was the date of that approximately?
I lose my perspective. Well, let's see, the Army closed, I would say probably around 1960. Mm-hmm.
Was that something that continued on up to the closing?
Yeah. Well, it's an economical way to make very complex pieces of machinery, and also to make to use special alloys, materials, so you know what you're getting in, and there's no loss, no waste if you're using expensive alloys.
But it required bringing in some special equipment that didn't exist.
Not too much, really. Yes, it did, but no worse than buying a new milling machine or something of that sort.
Yeah.
But you get an injection molding machine, and that's the heart of it, where you get your casting out.
The equipment existed on the market.
It's plastic equipment. Yeah. And as you said, that's an old process, and you probably go down to Providence there and find all kinds of equipment like that. They make a lot of this costume jewelry where this process is used. And you know the swimming pool they had there?
Well, it's gone by the time I came there. I've seen it on the maps.
Oh, that's still gone? Is that gone now? I don't know what's in there, I wonder. Well, it was in back of quarters four, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Between quarters four and 19.
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously they weren't allowed to have a swimming pool for pleasure of the officers. Mm. But they put that in for fire protection.
Yeah. So that's like a modern version of the old fire pond that they had in there.
Yeah, except that they allowed to put a springboard in the end of it and a couple of ladders.
That was a good swimming pool.
But it... and fenced in, but it was a dual-purpose deal. It did give them fire protection because they were very conscious of water supply after the fire.
After Building 20?
Yeah.
Well, now there's no trace of that left. You wouldn't know there was a pool there. I mean, if you didn't already know, there's no sign that there ever was one now. It's all just a parking lot.
There wasn't any particular... Oh, probably right over. Yeah, they were.
Yeah, they paved over it, you mean?
Yeah. See, we haven't been in around there since the Army closed. Went in once to the museum, that is all.
Who used to swim in this pool?
The officers in their company.
Yeah.
I'd go in and meet some of my friends, and they'd invite my kids to come in too.
Did you need a pass or just someone recognizing? How did that work?
Oh, no, you'd have to be a guest of them. It was for the officers.
And they'd
officers
call
only.
In and tell the officer on the gate that so-and-so was coming and let them in. You didn't just drive in there. You had to be... okay to get through the gate. Mm. Even if you were just going for a friendly little luncheon or something, the hostess would have to call a gate and say that I was coming in at such a time.
You couldn't go and say, I want to go and see Colonel So-and-so.
No.
They'd call Colonel So-and-so's quarters and say, really want to see this person?
Yeah.
But the kids of the officers didn't like it in there because they said they felt as if they were in jail. Mm-hmm. Whenever the kids in high school had friends they wanted to bring in, kids had to be checked in and not searched or anything, but they felt that they were going to a jail or something. It was confining, but still was a lovely post for the officer stationed there.
Well, the young people that objected to it, I couldn't understand why they objected. It was simply a matter of getting okayed at the gate. They didn't frisk them or anything. They simply, and then the young person would say where he was going, and they'd call that officer's house and say, so-and-so's here, shall I let him in? And I guess the kids objected to that.
Well, kids object to anything.
Yeah.
That's a lot worse at some military bases.
Oh,
yeah, I'd say it is.
Mild.
And then at some like Aberdeen, you can drive right through the base. Most parts of it. Yeah, parts that are restricted.
I went in there for years to their social hours, and I always had to stop at the gate until I said okay and waved you on.
Of course, some of the colonels had young daughters themselves.
Well, it's better than trying to find housing on the economy around here at that time.
You're certainly better living in quarters one than any place outside if you have that option.
Oh. See, one of the COs, I guess it was Colonel Crowe, came in. And they figured they'd been living in army quarters. The windows are so high that they're rather special for draperies, and you have to buy draperies. Well, they had, I think, draperies for 7 windows of those tremendous windows, and figured they were all set. And they moved into quarters 1, and I think I had 8 windows. There was a little alleyway walking from in building 16 in the first floor, from the right-hand end over to the left-hand end. Have you been through there?
But still there.
Yeah. But it wasn't when they first went there. If you hadn't wanted to go from the right-hand building, you had to go outdoors to get to the left-hand building. Colonel Holland was there. And he had a little reconstruction done for it, so you could walk all the way through under one roof. And they call it the Holland Tunnel.
Oh, really?
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah.
I know other things that when we were in the growing stage, I told you we were doing these barrel erosion tests where the bullets were coming out the side. You know the machine gun range that's down in the bottom of building 28? Mm-hmm. It's an extreme right-hand one. Well, we were firing down there one time. We had just gotten these long bursts and working at it. And we got a telephone call from something was buzzing by the City Hall Tower. And the bullets had chewed all the way through the sand butt at the end, made a core in it, and gone through the back end, and they were shooting right down by City Hall.
Heading for West Springfield, huh?
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing they didn't hit City Hall. But after that, they...
That would have been embarrassing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, they put up a... did quite a bit of looking into what you should do in your butts. And found, first of all, when you're firing long bursts, they build up a core of lead in there. And the sand doesn't slow the bullet down a bit. It just slides right along the edge of the core of lead, sort of tunnels it way through. Then when it gets to the concrete at the end, it's chewing into that. So we put up a barricade at the end of it with a space in between so you could see it. And that was a good armor plate, I believe, these armor plate and concrete. But you could inspect every morning, see if anything got through. And if anything did get through, it hit that barricade. And I imagine that's still there, down by the target house.
Hmm. Have to look for that.
Well, you said you wanted a story that things are a little bit
Yeah, that different. Sort of thing is not widely known.
Just well.
That's what I mean. It probably never got in the newspaper.
I know it didn't. And those firing butts that we put in Building 28, again, when we were just expanding, it was interesting. They're made of a 4-inch armor plate. And they came in sheets about 6 feet long, 8 feet long, and about 4 feet high, I would say. So we put a contract out to have them put in. And they came in with 2 men and a boy and put the whole thing in all by themselves. They couldn't put any overhead rigging because of the floor right above those butts. And they hauled those tremendously heavy things in. The boy was a small man, and he was there to get in spaces where the other 2 guys couldn't reach. But they did put those boxes in. They're boxes that are about 8 feet deep, and complete boxes of armor plate. They go right into the side hill. And again, we had to pull the core out from there because it would start to deflect and might be headed upstairs, something of that sort, if you didn't get that core out. We put in an electric sensing device about halfway back, so as soon as the bullets began to reach back there, the butt would be shut down, we'd clean the core out. So we sort of developed our own safety precautions as we went along. Well, initially, we reported directly to the Chief of Ordnance, the Office Chief of Ordnance in Washington. Then they came through with this reorganization plan and set up the Weapons Command out in Rock Island. You had all your weapons under one command out there, and your ammunition was down. Our dealing was with Frankfurt, but we didn't go to Washington at all after that, except to Rock Island, where the headquarters was.
When do you think weapons. Rock Island was chosen?
I don't know.
Do you think Springfield was in competition for that?
I don't really know. That was probably out of my reach.
Yeah. Washington-level decision, I guess.
Yeah. A part of the idea, of course, was dispersing, so everything wasn't in Washington, which made sense.
Yeah.
Why they went to Rock Island instead of here, I don't know. I think we probably were in competition. Lord knows what they may have been for maneuvering and politics, but I wasn't in on that.
Of course, Rock Island's nearer to the center of the country. Maybe that's a factor.
Yes, and to be moved from the coast, and it's near a manufacturing area, which I think was probably the primary choice. All of your Midwest manufacturing that got into the production, because this handled production as well. Mm. It was not just R&D, it was the whole small arms operation. So I suspect the prime factor was its location to manufacture it, as well as the safety of geography. And our contacts, primarily in OCO, were Bill Bonkemeyer and Bob Mitchell, and Colonel Studler was in charge of the operation for the initial part. Tom Cosgrove is the only one that's left, and he's still working there, I believe. Fred Carton was a civilian.
Still working
in Washington.
In Washington.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And Fred Carton was the civilian head. He has since died. Gordon Nam was in Washington when they set it up in Rock Island. He moved out to the Weapons Command, and he was our prime contract and small arms out there.
Now, again, approximately, I know you don't like exact dates, but when approximately was that?
Oh, I would guess somewhere in the early 50s. Mm-hmm. It ran on for a long time. And we had one, I think, very intelligent contact with the United Kingdom. They had a Colonel John Templebert. He was one of two men who were stationed in this country as representatives of Great Britain. Mm-hmm. He handled all of the small arms, knowledge, intelligence, and Colonel, Sir Freddie something or other, was the heavy work. But he would come up here and he'd sit in a meeting, he wouldn't take notes, and he'd go back and he'd write the most comprehensive report of a meeting that I've ever seen anyone do. He had a tremendous retentive memory, and he'd just make a few scribbles in the pad, and we'd review the notes later, and they're just absolutely perfect. Hmm. Well, can you think of anything else we should be turning into? Or?
Tell me about some of the conferences of ordnance.
Well, one that I always liked very much and I found quite good was started, and again, I can't tell you the time, but I would say it was probably early 60s or maybe late 50s. The chief scientist in Washington for Army decided that it would be a good idea to have all of your chief scientists or technical directors in the various installations get together at some out-of-the-way place, off-season.
Now, were these ordnance installations, or every...
most of them were ordnance, but there were some from chemical and some from signal. They had a little of everything. It was all Army, though. Mm-hmm. And the idea being that you'd get together there and you'd have discussions on various subjects and problems and a few speakers and socialize so that if you had a problem or got into another man's territory, or information that might help them, you could call them up and say, "Hey, Joe, how about this?"
Yeah.
And it worked out quite well, because you saw the same people about twice a year. They'd hit something like East Coast in Maryland when it was off-season, you could get good rates, or maybe Atlantic City in the wintertime, or something of that sort. And it worked out quite well, and we developed a lot of contracts that proved out. If you knew somebody was working on something, and you happened to run into that problem, or an answer to it, you could talk to them.
Did people give formal papers at these meetings?
Yeah.
I think we have some of those. Were they published the papers afterwards?
Probably. It wasn't too generally so, but...
But this was only Army. It didn't get into Navy or Air Force?
No, it didn't. Yeah. It was purely Army. We did get cross-service from things like the top management school out of Rock Island. You had an ordnance training deal out there, and they had various courses where you got people from other services as... well, as Army.
Did they bring in any civilians who were working on related contracts?
No, I would say not.
Just strictly military?
It was strictly... There were civilians who were in civil service.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not contractors.
Yes. Did you go to any of these yourself?
Yeah. I said I went to all of these with the chief scientist meetings. And I went to the crop management school, several other training schools out at OMEDA there. Management Engineering Training Agency.
So they had them in places like Atlantic City and...
Well, the chief scientist, that was the only thing. That lasted only while that particular chief scientist was in the White House. The one who came in after him discontinued it. But it, well, it got me acquainted, for example, with the chief scientist of Watervliet. And I got quite a bit of help from him, and I think may have helped him. I went down there after the Army closed and was trying to put in some of this... PERT system, showing them how we ran it and help them put it in there. And, oh, Tank Automotive, there's Joe Hayes out there. Of course, Ed Horn of our kind, but it just sort of tied all of your various lines together.
Seems like a good idea, basically. Otherwise, you wouldn't have contact with these people.
Yeah, sort of off in a padded cell, I guess.
You wouldn't even know they existed, much less have contact with them.
And you get a lot of the problems that you get one place to another are common, even though your product isn't the same, but the products and, well, working with engineers and your personnel problems and things of this sort, those don't change from one place to another.
Especially if you're all part of the Army.
Yeah. Well, compare, for example, your organizational structures and what your journeyman going wage is and what your rate of turnover is and why and what your... what sort of grievance problems you have coming up. And they're all in the common language if you're dealing with engineers and chemists and mathematicians.
Sure.
And you get cross-training, cross-breeding. You send people out. We had a fellow come in from Rock Island. He worked with us for about 6 months on a particular program. And then he went back and he started passing that stuff out of Rock Island. If you have one field in which you're particularly strong, you could get somebody detailed to come in and work in that area, and then he'll go back with what information he has and sort of act like a new source.
Mm.
Pause again. So whether...